Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are positively covering perhaps the most important thing we're going to do here in 2020, along with former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller. We are talking elections. All of our WNST programming and our Baltimore Positive programming brought to you by our friends at Taharka, made here in Baltimore. Man, this is my favorite. All of a sudden, pistachio has moved ahead of Honey Graham.
Did I tell you?
The pistachio is ridiculously good. Chock full of ground roasted pistachios. I got 2 pints in my fridge right now, or my freezer right now, as well as our friends at State Fair. I have not been over for the shrimp and grits in probably 6 months. I have had the chicken and waffles with the special raspberry jalapeno sauce. Don Moeller's been telling me about El Guapo. We're going to open that across the street in Catonsville. Very, very soon we'll be getting in there for some Latin and Mexican delights. Also, our friends at Fadley's will ship those crab cakes worldwide, anywhere you are, one click on the computer, you ship the Fadley's crab cakes, you become a hero, or you can stop down at Lexington Market and pick them up just the same. Moeller & Gary Realty closing deals, still 6 feet away. Go to MoellerandGary.com to learn more. And, of course, Jeff Moeller, Don's son, joined us last month to talk all things housing and the market and low interest rates. Don, I'm going to let you do the honors because election week was born of your frustration in early June. We have a guy here who's an executive in residence, a school of public and international affairs at my alma mater of the University of Baltimore. But you know him through elections, do you not?
Known John for a long time. He was actually a professor at my alma mater. I guess, was it Western Maryland then, John, or was it McDaniel at that time?
Oh, it was Western Maryland then.
Okay, so you even were pre-McDaniel. So we are pleased to welcome former Secretary of State John Willis to Baltimore Positive. John, thanks for joining us to talk about this important topic.
Well, it's good to be with you. How do I get earn one of those shirts you have?
You want the shirt or the hat?
You got the shirt. We got the hat. We got next time we're together and we're having crab cakes and chicken and waffles, we'll make sure we get you a shirt and a hat.
There you go.
John, let's just, you know, you really are one of the state experts on elections. I mean, you study the data. You drill down and down and down. Let's start, first of all, by having been someone that was in charge of the entire electoral process in the state. Give our listeners a sense of what kind of pressure and how challenging it is for local boards to make sure that it's easy to vote and that elections are something that we all have confidence in.
Well, I'm glad you phrased the question that way, because election administration is a complex task. Imagine if everybody in motor vehicles had to show up on the same day to register their car, or if everybody had to get a shot, an immunization on the same day. So what election officials have to do every 2 years in the state of Maryland is prepare for that unique experience of voting. And so it is a large task. And in Maryland, we're no longer a small state. We have over 4 million registered voters. And Baltimore County's got 850,000. The city's got about 470,000 voters. So there's a lot of people to deal with. And to ensure that everybody has an opportunity to vote is not a simple task, and it involves preparation, training, production of materials, acquisition of facilities, ballot preparation and proofreading, all of which are get complicated by things like a coronavirus pandemic.
Well, the mail-in part of this, you know, historically, this is something other states have done. It's something we did successfully earlier this year. I think this is where it gets muddled, because all of us young old-timers, and I'll consider myself even as a student of Don Moeller's, a young old-timer at this point, you know, gathered and gone to the elementary school or the school in the neighborhood or wherever they have voted, even going back to pulling the levers and having the forms that then, you know, in the modern era sort of slide through as you go out the door. This year has been completely different for me. I'm 52, and the ballots came this year, and I filled out the bubble, and I mailed it in. And then there was the process of going online and checking to make sure that my vote was counted. And It was a little clunkier, and I guess I'm a little older than a millennial. I'm not young enough to be completely hip to mobile and all of that, and old enough to have pulled a lever. But I think the whole country's coming together in a different way now with the digital part of this and then the U.S. postal part of this, where you register online and they're mailing you different things, that it has gotten a little muddled. And I think even as a 52-year-old guy that hosts Baltimore Positive, this is a little bit of a confusing period of time where do I go online? Are they mailing me something? What am I getting? And I think that Don and I are trying to set the record straight because it really has changed dramatically in a pretty short period of time as to the amount of options we now have, right?
Oh, that you're absolutely correct about the change. And every time you have system change, whether you transition from, you mentioned a couple different voting methods. Every time you have a transition from a voting method, it's an opportunity for one, the administrator and the staff, it's their first time, mistakes are more likely to happen. And more importantly, it's a change for the voter. And the voter is used to, regardless of their age, doing what they used to do before. And so when you have system change, you're gonna you have to take extra steps to make sure that you're educating the voter and that you're providing information that's useful to them. This is a big change because prior to 2020, the most number of absentee ballot votes ever was around 225,000. And we had 1.45 million in June.
So six times as many as before.
Six and a half times. And we're likely to have, depending on what voters choose, up to 2 million mail ballots.
And literally every one of those gets touched, right? They get mailed physically. They go through the whole mail system. Then they arrive. When we were told all about this a couple of months, you know, the separation process, the fact that they have to be fed through and read. The second ballot wouldn't count, right? But this is just a whole lot of like paper and humanity and weight and all of that, right?
Yeah, and they need to set up the local election boards. And you have a good one in Baltimore County, and there's a lot of experience in Baltimore City. I've worked with both of those boards over the last 20 years very closely. And they have a lot more back office needs in terms of doing the functions you just described. And if there's a disputed ballot, that has to be set aside if they can't read a signature or there's some imperfection or marking or something. And then the local boards, the five-member boards, there's a Board of Elections for Baltimore City, one for Baltimore County, and all the surrounding jurisdictions have their own election, local election boards. Those individuals have to resolve the dispute. And they're the final determiner of whether your ballot counts. Unfortunately, in the primary, one big thing everybody should do, tell everybody to sign the outside envelope on their ballot. We had over 3,000 ballots thrown out in the primary because the voter did not sign the back of the envelope. Now, we're actually better off than some states. Some states actually require that signature to be notarized. Some people require two signatures. I mean, there's all kinds of complex procedures around the country. We're actually pretty good on that. But the volume of it is what's new this time, the sheer magnitude of the amount of processing that takes place. Now, you mentioned vote by mail. There are other alternatives. We had almost 200,000 people in June not return their ballot by mail. They received their ballot by mail, but they took it to a drop box. And there were drop boxes in all the jurisdictions. We had 15 of them in Baltimore City. And so that's an option to use a drop box.
And that's a wonderful method, right? And that's an elongated period of time, right? That sits out there for a couple of weeks. At what point do we drop box?
Well, typically it was about the same – started the same time that early voting did, which was the second Thursday before. The state board, now that the governor's letter and yesterday's proclamation is on the table, they'll work out that exact start date of when you can return to what drop boxes. But that's something you may want to publicize in this program and just send it out, is because many people don't have access, believe it or not, ready. They don't drive. They don't have access to a car. Going to a post office can be, not all post offices are in ideal locations. So a drop box, whether it's near a library or a school or at the county office building, is a reasonable alternative. I work a lot with the National Vote at Home Institute that's based as a big national board. Former Secretary of State of Oregon runs it. I communicate with him regularly. And they've taken to using a term is vote at home. So you're not really using the mails to vote. You're marking your ballot at home, and then how you deliver it is up to you. You can take it to an early voting center. You can take it to a polling place. You can take it to the election board, or you can use a drop box. And in fact, in Oregon, which was the first state to have regular, consistent statewide vote by mail, 60% of their ballots are delivered to a drop box. They're not really mailed. And so we want to encourage people to take advantage of that, particularly the closer to the election. Say you get your ballot on the Friday before election. You really don't have time to put it in the mail and get it postmarked and delivered, you know, in time. In Maryland, the key thing is postmark. So to be sure, take it down. That's what I did in the primary. I took mine to the drop box in front of the local board of elections and put it there.
I still miss the levers, John. I'm not going to lie to you. You know?
I hope you remember this, Don, but there was a county commissioner, Murray Levy, and from Charles County. He had voted in the old lever machines, and he won well. He was got a lot of votes in Charles County, was president of commissioners, but he one time had an election, and he got zero votes out of a particular machine in his home precinct. And what happened was the lever machines break, and they're subject to mechanical failure.
Well, I remember hanging chads had the whole country.
They're the worst. We had that in Carroll County one time, hanging chads on a school board race. They declared the wrong winner the first time, and then they had to rerun the ballots in Frederick County and found out that Ed Lippy, the incumbent, actually won.
I have a feeling a guy of your age and era has done a lot of hanging chad interviews over the course of years, right? If you're in the election business, right?
And what bothered me was Montgomery County, and you remember Marie Garber? She was the director of elections statewide years ago, and she was the Montgomery, very experienced. I learned a little bit from Marie, but she frightened me one time because Montgomery used the punch cards. They used to, the staff in the office would scrape off the chad. Well, that's like casting votes when you do it, because you're either in causing an overvote, meaning people are making more than one selection, or you're casting a ballot for somebody that wasn't intended to be cast. So chads were the worst. Punch cards were the worst.
Well, Don, remember the All-Star ballots they would give us at Memorial Stadium, right?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
The only thing I know from the hanging chads. Because I get the, I'd be punching in there for Mark Belanger.
Robbie Alomar.
I still got
Robbie. John, 2020, here we are, and we've got a president who literally every single day, more than once, tweets, trying to stoke this fear in the American public that you're no longer going to be able to count on fair elections in the United States of America. You, as opposed to the president, have studied voting all across this nation. What do you say to our listeners about the security of voting by mail in the United States of America in 2020?
The president is just trying to create chaos, generally.
We've noticed.
He and his family have all voted by mail. You know, they've all voted by mail. And some of them have voted in the wrong place by mail. And some of them failed to sign their envelopes and didn't get their votes counted. But it is simply a made-up political palaver. And if we could use an old word.
There's a word you don't hear every day on Baltimore Positive, Nestor. A palaver.
A pedantic palaver. You know?
That is an Alan Stockett word. I'm Googling it right now. That's an SAT word, man. We don't. Yeah,
that's right. But the you got to have one of those in every class, you know.
Well, Nestor's a UB guy. He'd be looking it up. But John, talk folks through the five states. What have we learned from the five states that have been doing this now for a while? What have we learned about turnout and security and the effectiveness of what you'll call vote at home?
Yeah, well, the we've learned that the incidence of mail ballot fraud is very small. I mean, just in terms of total votes compared to the number of instances where someone tried to cast more than one vote. Or the most recent case, it's kind of ironic, it was a Republican congressional race in 2018 where some person who's currently under trial, so I can't say too much, went around and, quote, harvested votes, meaning he collected them for people and said he would return them to the local board and instead mark the ballots or discarded them. He did whatever he could to influence the elections in that congressional district. And so there are instances of that happening around the country. But when you compare it to the hundreds of millions of votes that are cast, the number is relatively small.
Well, and more than that, institutionally, as opposed to, and I, Don and I were talking earlier, Don, I was going to compare it to sort of like Tim Conway and Harvey Korman is, you know, cast in some bad movie as bumbling, you know, I'm going to vote in this county and vote in that county and I'll vote twice. But like legitimately nefarious institutional, fraudulent, operational as an operative, That doesn't happen in this country historically.
The election boards, you can feel very confident here in Maryland about the local election boards. And as I tell the election judges, you know, back in the days pre-COVID, pre-coronavirus, 1% of the voters were actually election judges. So that's a self-check right there on any kind of, there is no evidence, and I can tell you this, there is no evidence of systematic attempted fraud over the last several decades in Maryland on the part of any political party, on the part of any candidate, on the part of any outside group. There have been people who have tried to test the system. We had a woman in Colbert County register her dog to vote. She got prosecuted. We had a guy in Hagerstown who registered under a false name and tried to run for mayor, and he got caught. We had a candidate living in your county, home county, who voted in Florida and voted in Maryland, and she got caught. So there are
dead people voting. I mean, we always hear that that's sort of the urban legend, right?
Like, there was actually one that I use in class all the time in Baltimore County, and a lot of those instances, and they're instances, they're not widespread. A father dies the weekend before the election, the son goes in and votes for the father, or the mother for the daughter, or you get those kinds of stories that happen. In the old days, the dead voter story was basically when everything was hand processed, the card was pulled improperly. The voter authority card was pulled improperly from a stack, and the person signed it and voted, and when they went to reconcile the ballots post-election, they found an error. There was in the old city paper, there was an old expose from the early 90s and 80s that went track down every one of Sowerbrey's claims, you know, from the 1994 and found nothing, you know.
Well, that's not unlike, John. It's not unlike, right, that the president – what's getting lost in all this is President Trump had a commission to find voter fraud and irregularities, and they shut down because they couldn't – the president's own commission could not find any.
Well, I know several of the members of that commission. They're former secretaries of state, particularly the one who was the best was the Secretary of State of Maine, who was the one raising the questions about where's the proof, you know, where's the evidence. And so that went aside. Let me give you another assurance. We did at we responded at the Attorney General's office to Congressman Cummings, who made an inquiry after the 2012 election, just like you made this afternoon, Don. And in that election, out of 2.4 million voters, we, after the election is over, the voter authority card, the poll books are reconciled with the MD voters. We ended up with two cases out of 2.4 million instance voters in Maryland. Last time, in 2016, we went through the same process, and a list is developed of anybody what's an apparent double voter. And the State Board of Elections, they have a person there that's job is to reconcile.
That would be somebody who would mail in a ballot and then go and try to vote the second time, or no?
Or showed up on a precinct and tried to impersonate a voter or whatever.
Okay.
You know, whatever.
Attempted. Somebody that's attempted to put two cards in. Okay.
Or mistakenly. One, you know.
Sure.
A lot of times it's families who mistakenly do that. We had a woman in Cumberland whose mother had voted by absentee ballot, but she took her to early voting, and she tried to vote at early voting. So that ended up as a provisional ballot. And so they have to be reconciled.
But
so
this is a handful. I mean, you're giving us, like, sort of, you know.
No, but these are the kinds of things that people want to make into voter fraud. And they're
right.
Simply administrative mistakes or personal mistakes that don't amount to any systematic effort. And certainly the election boards themselves, you know, in Maryland have done very well over the last several decades. Now, I can't speak for the 1850s, you know, or other periods.
Well, you don't look that old. Come on, Chuck.
Well, I've studied those votes. I mean, you know, but that's why after the Civil War period, we didn't start registering voters till the 1880s. Before that, the parties actually produced the ballots and, you know.
John, my mom was born in 1919 before suffrage. I mean, so, like, my mother was born without the right to vote. So,
right.
You know, that's why we put so much attention on this. You know, for all the years you've been involved in this and doing it and seeing it and seeing it change, I think there may be a good part to all the tyranny that we're enduring, because we are talking about this, right? Like, regular citizens, we're doing a whole week of conversations here about this, because it is a little more personal and is a little different than just putting your card in like I did when I turned 18 and showing up at the elementary school every 2 years. There's a lot more interest in this now, especially with Russia and digital and online and the Postal Service, and how many moving parts there are. There's a lot more discussion about it than maybe there is in other years.
Well, that, you know, that's what this current federal administration is giving everybody, a big civics lessons on separation of powers and civic responsibility and duty. And there is a silver lining there. That's why you call this show Baltimore Positive. You're looking
well,
for
the, we try.
Hey, listen, Mueller came along. Listen, Mueller came in my life in 82. He was a guidance counselor then. I missed the whole – I didn't get a chance to sign up for Mr. Mueller's history course. So that's kind of what this is a civics class, for, I think, for everyone, right? But this is the most important – responsibility we have as citizens, as Americans.
Well, it is important. Any government service, in, you know, voting, I would put at the top. You as a citizen need to take the care to do the right thing, and to take care of your vote. Don't expect somebody else to take care of your vote. You've got to make sure you're properly registered. One of the reasons, and we're going to, any mass database that you have is going to have 5% of that mail not show up. That's the post office's own internal studies. You know, you do a mailing of 4 million people, 200,000 are not going to get their mail. And that's to either not be delivered, misdelivered. I got a piece of mail from somebody two blocks over the other day. That's not no fault of the person over.
So that's been going on all of our lives, literally, right?
I still get mail. And it follows me from address to address. I've moved several times. I'm always dumbfounded. I still get mail addressed to my mother, who has been gone 22 years. It's just like you said, John, things just happen, but there's not massive fraud. Now, speaking of voting, you've been pretty outspoken. Governor Hogan came out and for whatever reason chose to attack the Board of Elections, called June an unmitigated disaster, and Nestor and I anecdotally found it to be very successful. It certainly worked in our households. We had no trouble voting. And you've really stood up and said, wait a minute. It really wasn't an unmitigated disaster. And let me give you some data to prove that. So we're with John Willis, former Secretary of State. So John, educate our listeners. Tell them why June wasn't an unmitigated disaster.
Well, again, I think, you know, before I critique the election, let me just say this. I do this every day. I teach this. I write about it. I research it. And the best thing we could do in this country is to take the politicians out of the administrative process. Let the professional administrators run the elections like they do in Canada. Because a lot of the comments that get said and the adjectives that are used have no basis in fact. And so the governor was upset over certain anecdotal reports he got, others in Annapolis, about ballots that were late or whatever. And there were a set of things he was upset about. In one, 90,000 voters in Prince George's County got their instructions in Spanish, when not their ballot, although he says ballots in the paper. It wasn't the ballots that were in Spanish. It was the instructions were in Spanish. And so a second mailing had to be done to those people who got that Spanish ballot instruction. But we had the largest turnout ever in the history of presidential primary elections, with over 1.5 million people voting.
Make it easy for people to vote, they'll vote, right? Make it something that...
The other thing that happened, which is unusual, is the county, the jurisdiction with the highest turnout, was Baltimore City. That doesn't happen in a normal election. You have to go back to in the 1950s, when Baltimore was 50% of the state's population, you know, or post-World War II era, to find that situation of where Baltimore's turnout was actually better than any other county. And it was the highest turnout in Baltimore City for a presidential Democratic primary in the history of the state. So I don't know how you can call that an unmitigated disaster when the turnout numbers were excessive. Four jurisdictions set records.
We had this sort of that wonky thing in the first with the typo. That was kind of a weird thing, right?
Pardon?
Then we had that in the first year, we had a typo.
The first Councilmatic district, what happened was, they first of all, you have to understand there are hundreds of ballot styles. And so when they proofed them before they sent it back to the printer, they corrected an error. But when it went back to the printer in the first district, there was a line left out about a judge race. So there was an extra space. What happened is the ballots got misaligned. They were printed with the wrong timing marks. And when the voters went to cast them, they were not capturing the vote in that judge race because of the misprinting of the ballot. And so those ballots had to be hand marked and then run through again. But there was no fraud. There was no, you know, whatever. It took extra time for the Baltimore City Board of Elections to process those ballots because they had to hand count them. And that's what happened there. The mistake that the state board made was it happened late on election night, and they took all the results down. And of course, that's what caused concern. I was on a call a couple weeks ago, and the report was that 90% of election boards around the country don't have a communications person, somebody like you, Nestor, that could help them out communicating with the media. And the lesson is, and you learn that in a seminar, is if you have a problem running an election, tell the public. Don't try to hide anything. Tell them. right away what happened. And the public can deal with it, but the political leadership sometimes get carried away with an administrative problem. You've seen that, Don, on a variety of things, I'm sure.
Well, I was going to say, John, that's folks who've worked with me, and I always give Lanny Davis, former Clinton official, credit for this, but on a whiteboard in my office, it always said, tell it all, tell it first, tell it yourself. And it's been on every whiteboard that I've ever had. Tell it all, tell it first, tell it yourself. Nothing good ever comes from trying to hold back the truth or delay the truth. Be in charge of the message, be upfront. And as you said, people are fairly forgiving. You know, it's interesting, John and Nestor. I don't know if you follow. Recently, the president went on another one of his rants about there's this tremendous voter fraud in Virginia. There's 500,000 ballots that have been sent to all the wrong people. And look at that. There's just an example. Look at Virginia. You can't trust anything. So I thought, I've got to find out more about what that is. So I go on and I research. And what it is an independent third-party group that was hoping to encourage people to apply for absentee ballots, sent out information with inadvertently the wrong return address on it. Instead of Fairfax County, it was Fairfax City. Right. It wasn't the government sending it out. It was a third-party group who is accepting responsibility and said, yep, we got the address wrong. We're going to fix it. Nothing to do with voter fraud, but if you're driving down the road,
a candidate or a party,
and listening to Fox News, you would think that 500,000 ballots went to the wrong people, and that's just not what's happening in the United States of America.
Yeah, we need to be very careful about using terms like the difference between, he got into a tiff with the Attorney General and Secretary of State in Michigan, both of whom I know, and I deal with young professional folks who just won their election in 2018, and that's what they did in Michigan. They didn't mail ballots. They mailed applications for ballots. And you don't attack that process, you know. You got to be careful. But the election boards, there are a couple things for your audience if they want to check out. You can always check out the National Association of Secretaries of State as a trusted source of information. The National Association of State Election Directors is another good source. The Election Assistance Commission, which is headquartered in Maryland, right outside DC, is another trusted source of information. And even the Department of Homeland Security, the CISA, the Center for Interagency Security, has gotten involved in mainly on the technology interference front, but they're providing other guidance to state and local jurisdictions. And those are good resources for people to check when they hear something like you heard. Go check it out.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. John, Nestor and I have been beating the drums. We were all over it back in June, and we're on it again, and we're getting at least some encouraging signs. But I want to get your opinion on this, and that is, as you know, right now, unless the Maryland Board of Elections or the governor waives this regulation regarding absentee ballots, they won't even at local boards be able to open up the absentee ballots that are coming in for weeks until 2 days after the election. I'm assuming that you support and encourage a change to allow them to count those ballots and secure them prior to Election Day.
Well, to process them, the way I would phrase it is I would let the boards process them. I wouldn't necessarily, you have to be careful about counting because you don't want any of that leaking out. So you have to have heightened security around whatever scanning of the ballots you do, but certainly the processing of it. And just and many states do it, what you suggested, many states do it, but you have to be very careful. The local boards have to be very careful about the security once they open an envelope and prepare it for scanning and counting. Yeah, those dates need to be adjusted because it's a different world with, say, we have 2 million ballots come in by mail. That's very different than if a local board's dealing with 10 or 20,000, you know.
Nestor, how smart would you have been had you had Professor Willis at UB, huh?
Well, I'll tell you what, I know a lot more about elections, that's for sure. John T. Willis is the executive in residence of School of Public and International Affairs at my alma mater of UB and has been an enlightening guest today. And we certainly will reach back to you as we get closer up onto this election season. And as the rules sort of slide and coronavirus and all of this, we need to have a fair, safe election we can all have confidence in. And I think we're moving in that direction.
Well, I have confidence in the state and local administration. The coronavirus is the big unknown, and how the voters are going to react to the system that's being designed is also going to be challenging, and we need to keep track of that and try to accommodate the voter.
Well, it just as long as we get everybody who's eligible and should be voting, and make it easy, Dropbox, mail-in. Obviously, some precincts are going to be open as well. I appreciate your time today, John. Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Former Secretary of State of Maryland, absolutely, and a longtime election insider, along with former County Executive Don Moeller. We are Baltimore Positive, powered up by our friends at Taharka Ice Cream. I'm going to hold the vanilla bean up because vanilla bean gets kicked around and it's underrated and it's delicious, especially if you have some fresh peaches this time of the year as well. State Fair in Catonsville and our friends at El Guapo, as well as Fadley's. Order those crab cakes. They are delicious. And if you're buying or selling a home, please consider our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller and John Willis, former Secretary of State, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, local, calm, and Baltimore positive.